Welcome to Coffee Ukuda. In this episode, I'm joined by Sam Monahan, a senior town planner at Zone Town Planning. Sam?
Thanks, Kuda.
Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. I think first question for you, mate, is what are you seeing in the market at the moment? From pre-COVID 2019, and we're now early 2024, how are we... Are there more DAs going into council? What's the trend at the moment in the market? Is there excitement in let's go, or what's your take on it at the moment?
Taking a step back to 2019, into 2020, COVID kicked off and the market sort of pressed pause for a moment.
Yep.
And then as money became so cheap, developers were picking up land left, right, and centre.
Yeah.
Pushing forward with DAs, and we were extremely busy sort of 2021, 2022. Particularly with sort of larger scale projects, tower projects, and there was a lot of, market drive around lifestyle, livability, and people wanted to move to the coast, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane. Yeah. People either wanted a holiday home here, be it a unit, beachfront, or wanted to actually leave those metropolis cities and move to the Gold Coast permanently.
And you could work from home as well. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there was the demand, and those other cities, Sydney, Melbourne, there was such value they saw in Gold Coast.
Yeah.
That, it really spurred on a drive for premium apartment product.
Yeah.
And that moved for probably a good couple of years. Particularly, we were lodging a lot of DAs in 2021, 2022, start of 23. It's sort of those larger scale projects have tapered off now with rate rises, the construction industry, the way it is at the moment, and trying to get projects to actually stack up.
Oh, yeah.
As you'd find, it's the DAs that we're doing at the moment, a lot of them were doing minor changes, other changes to work with builders and developers to find that balance, strike the sort of happy medium between the cost versus price people are willing to pay for those units.
Yeah, and so with those DAs that you worked on, let's say 2-3 years ago, how many, once you got the approval, do you know what percentage of them have actually gone ahead? What are you finding? What's in construction?
Or hard to say how many have gone ahead, but certainly not as many as we would like.
Yeah.
And that's just because of the nature of the market, construction industry, and the way that sort of things have panned out.
Yep.
Look, it's always the way that some landowners want to get uplift on their sites too.
True.
And they borrow against that, use that equity to do other projects. But this certainly was a real push and influx of getting DAs approved.
Yeah.
And then clients would take those DAs to a builder, multiple builders, get a tender doc done, and then it just doesn't work.
Yep.
So then they'd either go back on the market with a DA approval, which we'd see plenty of, and we'd have a lot of clients coming to us, new clients, old clients, saying, what can we do with this site? How can we modify this DA? And what are your thoughts around it? So that's sort of the phase we're in at the moment, is sites coming to market. Those clients coming to us saying, how can we modify this approval to get either more yield or change the yield, restructure the project so it's actually viable.
Yeah. I'm starting to sound like a broken record in this, right? But because of that situation 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the excitement of the Gold Coast is booming, there's a lot of work going ahead.
Mm.
It was the energy of let's just get a DA in, or everything was profitable, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't, everything's hard work, but it wasn't as hard work to get a job to stack. Yeah. Everyone, there was uncertainty of what's going to happen during COVID, any jobs going to go ahead. Builders wanted to secure work.
Mm-hmm.
And what they realized very quickly is, there's a lot of work, and we priced these jobs way too keen, and it's going to cost us a fair bit. Now we're in the position with a few jobs as well where, how do we get this to stack, and how do we actually put some smarts in it to create a product that's going to be profitable?
Yep.
Right. And it's hard with the builder market at the moment. There aren't many around, and the ones that are around, especially in that $20+ million market,
yes,
they're naming their price, right? And their price is not cheap. Some of it is not feasible. And honestly, I think there needs to be a relook at the model of how we deliver things. I've been toying around with just even how the builder-developer model becomes a bit more efficient. And then that builder-developer model can actually be profitable for the developer and it's less risk. So I see the market moving a lot towards that builder-developer model until someone, and we're going to need three or four builders, wants to step into that $20 to $50 million market.
Yeah.
And that's, it's a very interesting time, right? Because it's frustrating.
Yep.
But we're getting there. But I mean,
yeah, look, I think, I'll add to that too, Kuta, that I have clients that will work with a builder from the outset. And
yep.
I think that's really a good shift in the mentality from a builder tendering yep. on a project and then either not winning it or just overshooting the market
yep.
because they just hit and hope, you know, see what happens. But if a developer is working with a builder from the outset, in terms of the FISO,
yeah,
that's really a way that the client, the developer, understands where they're going to be at the end of the project
yep.
from the outset, rather than getting a DA approved for the yield that they're after and what they sort of FISO, you know, they think that
yeah.
stack up, and then the builder comes in and says, no, that's going to cost you this.
Yeah.
So from the outset, I've got clients that will have that builder engaged and they're working through sort of documentation almost. At the
yeah.
same time, they're working up a DA scheme, looking at transfer slabs, trying to rule out precast elements that are going to cost a fortune for, you know,
from the start,
planters,
yeah.
things like that. So that when we get to the end of the project, in terms of the DA phase, they can actually get built.
Yeah.
You know, we're lodging management plans with council, we're doing upworks, and then they're straight into basement or
into the
construction. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's really a good shift in the model. And more developers should be sort of looking at that.
You really can't tender anymore, right? You know, I'd love to tender, right? It's competition, and the whole concept behind it is you get the sharp pricing because everyone's trying to win the work.
Yep.
At the moment, the work is there. And if you're tendering, I've got 1 in 3 chance of getting this job. I'm not going to put too much thought into it, right? Because the work is there. And I'm really loving that shift as well, where it's, let's get in with the builder, let's have a conversation, and we get those smarts in there, like, early on. And it's a form of, it's proper early contractor involvement where you actually get their design managed and they get their design input into it. But yeah, moving on to, because I'm actually the one interviewing you. I'm not used to talking a lot when I'm interviewing people. With developers, right, when do you recommend that the conversation starts with you, right? It's early in the piece would you want that conversation to happen?
Generally at acquisition phase.
Yep.
So we routinely, you know, I might do 5, 6, 7, 8 planning advices a week.
Yep.
On sites for developers. And that's them looking at, so what constraints and opportunities can I identify at that point in time before a developer actually acquires a site?
Yep.
And our role in that sort of phase is to identify those constraints and then push the project in the right direction.
Yep.
Or involve engineers, enviro,
yep.
ecologists, whoever it may be, have pre-lodgement meetings with council in a DD phase, depending yep. on the nature of the project. And generally, you know, our work is typically based around the Gold Coast and Queensland generally.
Uh-huh.
So we have a good relationship and understanding of the city plan, which we operate under, so the
yep.
planning parameters. And we can then advise clients on, you know, what the sort of yield should be for the site,
yep.
you know, highest and best uses and things like that. So yeah, back to your question. Typically, it's at the very beginning of the project from the outset.
Yeah.
And then we'll be involved once the acquisition has taken place. We sort of move into the next phase with the design. Yeah. Say we're looking at a mid-rise tower. We'll set some parameters for the architect to work off,
yeah.
built form parameters, building heights, setbacks, site covers, car parking. And then the scheme's developed up from there.
Yeah.
And that can sort of all works in with the FISO.
Yeah.
And then we take it to the next step and get the consultant group on board and have further input into the design and then progress to the TA phase.
So that runs into my next question with the consultant group, right? How do you pick the right team for said development, right?
Mm.
What are we looking at when we're talking all the reports that need to go in? what are we looking for when we're picking that team?
Yeah, good question. I think what's really important is foresight in terms of, so not just the DA phase, is can an engineer look at construction phase as well and think about implications of what they're doing at DA phase and how it'll actually be implemented down the track.
Yeah,
it's quite common that we'll get a DA through and then at documentation phase, you know, there's additional information provided, spot levels on infrastructure and things like that, and all of a sudden the stormwater strategy doesn't quite work. So we're then going back to find a resolution to that, and often that can mean a minor change back to council, which is costs and also time impediments too for the construction phase. So if we can get a good team on board from the outset and avoid those issues, that's a really good place to start. I think another key thing too, Kuta, is utilising local consultants for the area you're developing in. And that's important because those consultants have firstly good relationships with local government.
And that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. They can pick up the phone and make that call to the councillor offsider that they know well and discuss an issue. Even before the DA is lodged or in a DD phase. And also because they know the planning schemes up, say we're dealing in an Innisfail DA or something like that, you know, you use a local consultant up there, they know the infrastructure requirements and design requirements for those sort of things. You might use a traffic engineer up there that understands council's standards and tolerances for shortfalls in car parking. Yeah. You know, and those are the little intricacies that can really assist a FISO at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So getting those guys on board early in the process, and particularly using local consultants, I think is a really good attribute to a DA.
It's funny, I'll jump in here because it goes into the conversation we're having before we started shooting about the Broncos, your Broncos versus the Panthers, and that experience in the grand final coming in handy. Right.
That's right.
So local knowledge is that experience, right? They've done this over and over and over again, and you don't have to go through the pitfalls they've had to go through. You're leaning on that experience, and you know what to do in those moments.
Exactly, so, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, local experience.
Local experience. Is there a third one, or it's really those two, foresight and that local knowledge?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's also good to build relationships with your consultant group as well.
Yep.
Because then you know how to work with those guys. If they need more time, you can work with them, or if you know they're going to deliver up front, then you can sort of strategize to bring forward the program and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's then the I'm big on relationships, right? Because maybe it comes from playing team sport, but if you know that, you know, you're going to war with someone, you want someone who's going to go all in and you can trust to do the best they can.
Yeah.
You can pick up the phone and actually get to a point where, okay, we're pushing program here, we need to get this in, or, you know, we can be slack here, or slack is not a good word, but we can relax this situation and sort of move around and work with that relationship. So I fully agree.
It's also just good working with good people too.
Exactly.
People you want to have a beer with Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
Go for a lunch here and there.
Well, we spend more time at work than with our families, right?
Yeah, true.
You know, it's not ideal, but we spend a lot of time at work and we spend a lot of time having these phone calls, having these conversations, and you don't want to dread doing that.
That's
right. You still want to feel like, you know, you look forward to doing it. You look forward to actually battling with these people and having the conversations. Can be the hard conversations, can be the easy conversations, but you look forward to it. And, you know, you said, grab a beer and on a Friday and talk about life and then you move on with it.
I think the last one there too, Kuta, is no dickhead policy.
that's extremely important.
Yeah.
Extremely important. And my favorite topic, timeframes.
Right. Yes.
Because that's usually where I focus on, like timeframes.
Sure.
What are you seeing at the moment? What timeframes are you lying or to get into this DA phase, or really allowing for the DA, or focus on the Gold Coast at the moment?
Yep.
Like those council timeframes, how do we expedite them? Mm. What are you seeing at the moment from a timeframe perspective?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, we went through that that phase 2020, end of 2020, 21, 22, where we were lodging a lot of DAs in council, Gold Coast particularly, and that put a pressure on the capacity of council's DA team to really produce those approvals in a timely manner, which is understandable. You know, it's a staffing issue.
Yeah.
And in combination with that, they were losing a lot of staff to the industry and to state government at the same time. So they had their own issues internally to deal with, plus the large number of DAs. So
coming in, yeah.
Yeah, look, they did a really good job to get DAs out in that time period. Now we've moved into a phase where not as many DAs are being lodged, and the officers are telling us that.
Yep.
And they're also recognising the need to issue development approvals, particularly around housing, to assist with the housing shortage. So it's really good to see the officers sort of come to the party and look to expedite things.
That's good.
But in general terms, so the Planning Act prescribes development assessment timeframes, which is really unique and good for Queensland. Mm-hmm. New South Wales system is not the same. We have an applicant-driven process in Queensland, and the councils have a prescribed timeframe to issue the confirmation notice or the acceptance of the development application, which is 10 business days, the information request, which is another 10 business days, and then it's over to the consultant group to respond to that within 3 months.
Okay.
And then council has 25 business days to decide the application. That applies to code-assessable development.
Yeah.
So that they're sort of locked into those timeframes, and we work with the officers to give them more time, and they give us more time when we need it.
Yeah.
And look, that goes back to my point earlier with using consultants in the area, because then you've got that relationship with the officers to work with them, and they work with us.
Yeah.
In terms of an impact application, which involves public notification, generally the timeframes are a bit further strung out because you've got that public involvement, and you never know what's going to happen in that phase.
Yep.
And, you know, I just had one go through at Chevron Island where we expected probably to receive a few objections. It was impact for building height, and it sailed through.
Oh, nice.
Not one objection. So you can never pick it besides anything in Palm Beach. You go above the height down there, you're going to cop a few. and that then pushes out your DA timeframes and impact assessment. Council officers have discretionary decision-making powers where they're not bound to decide the application within the prescribed timeframes.
Mm-hmm.
Under a code assessable DA, we have the ability to lodge what's called a deemed approval and force council's hand to approve the application.
Yep.
With an impact application, that provision doesn't apply. You can only have a deemed refusal and take a refusal to courts.
Yep.
So you're sort of moving on that next phase to take council to the P&E court.
Okay, so if I'm a developer, right, new to the Gold Coast, I want to push the boundaries of a bit and go impact accessible.
Yep.
Which areas? I know you mentioned Palm Beach.
Yep.
I think everyone's aware of that one.
Yep.
Which areas would you focus on, right?
Mm-hmm.
To go impact, and which areas would you avoid?
Sure. Look, it's very hit and miss.
Yeah.
You never know who the neighbour's going to be
and
what issues they're going to raise with the development application. But so with the Gold Coast planning scheme, if you're doing resi in the medium density or high density residential zones with a building height overlay map,
yep.
As soon as you go above that building height overlay map, you trigger impact assessment.
Yep.
And that's where the public get to have their say, and there's a third party appeal risk associated with that.
Yep.
In terms of locations, Palm Beach is certainly a hotspot, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of sort of community group movement down there, and they're quite well-versed in what the planning provisions are and what their rights are in terms of making submissions and third-party appeal.
Yeah.
Other areas, say Labrador, Bigger Waters and those areas, is probably not such a drive from the community up there to push against development progression. It all depends on your circumstance and the local area. So in the last 3-4 years, we've seen a really big push in Mermaid Beach in Miami, east of the Gold Coast Highway, for impact applications. And that's to achieve an additional level of typical level, maybe a penthouse, and then have a rooftop sort of private
amenity area
up there. And look, there's been some cases where those have been taken to court and the judge will rule in favour of the developer.
Yeah.
Other times that judges ruled in favour of the objectors or the neighbours. So it's really hit and miss up there with how the court's been applying the provisions. But it's not something that we can typically advise our clients on, you know, in terms of picking up a site and them understanding who's going to be an objector. You know, Chevron Island was a great case. We've got some wealthy owners in the place around it and across the road. there was a low-rise building and we're going to block some of those views, and we thought we'd certainly receive an objection or two. Maybe not an appeal from those guys, but...
An objection or something.
Yeah, that's right. Because loss of views is everything on the Gold Coast, yeah. Especially in and around the water areas.
Yeah, I was going to say, as long as you're not avoiding the... If you're not blocking the ocean views, you've got a better chance, but it's still a roll of the dice.
It really is, yeah.
Yeah. And from a design parameters and pushing the design, what are council willing to accept at the moment, and what are the areas that they're just strong on that you can't go when you're looking at your design?
Yeah, sure. We've sort of seen a shift in recent times in the Gold Coast in terms of the planning officer's application of certain provisions.
Yep.
So we went through a phase when we're lodging all these DAs, 2020, 2021, 2022, for towers particularly. We were trying to push the envelope to maximise GFA, year return, that sort of thing. At that point in time, developers weren't really thinking about the cost implications of producing that much GFA. It was sort of just jam as much as we can on the site.
Yeah.
And that's a high site cover, reduced setbacks. And because there were so many of these tower DAs coming in, council officers sort of drew a line in the sand in terms of what their expectations were for site cover and setbacks for different building heights and certain size sites, essentially. And that sort of set the tone for what their expectations were. And in recent times, with the market the way it is, there's been a real understanding of council officers that they need to be a part of providing the housing that we need in the city over the next 25 years. So they're really coming to the table now and listening to us in terms of sort of relaxing on those setback guidelines that they developed a couple of years ago. They're still applying setback site cover provisions reasonably, you know, asking for sort of 4 metres to 5 metres on towers, 20 to 30 stories, but they're open to certain elements projecting into that to give us some flair, architectural flair and the like to get these towers approved and constructed at the end of the day.
Yeah, and that's the most important thing, right? We've got to get them built at the end of the day.
Yeah, and like I mentioned earlier, you know, with the minor changes that we're lodging, the officers are really, really good at the moment in understanding that the market's shifting so rapidly and developers are trying to make these things stack up. And normally when you do your tender, you understand where the weak points are and where you can change the development to improve those cost efficiencies.
Yeah.
So we're going back with minor changes on a regular basis, and the officers are working with us to get those through at a pretty quick pace as well.
Yeah.
Because they understand that we're in that sort of sensitive period between DA approval and construction phase. And moving forward with them. Yeah. So it's good to see.
And with the city plan, the amendments, right, that have been put on hold, Abel, can you give us a bit of context around it and what your thoughts are on it and what the implications are?
Sure. It's quite a complex issue, Kuda, and one that spans back a number of years. In terms of the changes, I suppose I can probably outline some of the critical changes because it was quite a large package that council sought to push through.
Yeah.
The other councils within Queensland do rolling changes to their city plans, like the Sunshine Coast. I think they're up to version 28. Whereas Gold Coast, we've only just had version 11 rolled in.
It
been in place since 2016 on the Gold Coast, and I think Sunny Coast was 2014. So you can really see the evolution of their planning schemes compared to ours. They're different planning schemes, though. We have more of a broader zoning approach, whereas they have quite a lot of local planning areas, more so than just broad zoning. But in doing that, so council, probably Gold Coast, that is, kicked off their city plan major 2 and 3 amendments back in, say, 2016, 2017, 2018, really advancing it in 2019 to state interest review. And then from there, they've gone into public consultation. So it was quite a large package that they sought to push up, and they called it major change 2 and 3. The real critical changes that I'll outline include the targeted growth areas, and they were the areas of Bigara Waters, Labrador, and Southport.
Yeah.
And they sought to increase the building heights, density, and upzone a lot of those areas.
Yeah.
From medium density to high density, from low to low medium or to medium.
Medium.
There was building height changes across the city, some for the better, some for the worse.
Yep.
So in, say, the Mermaid Beach areas, you know, down at Awoonga and Gwala Park,
Yeah.
The building height in there at the moment is 15 metres and mm-hmm. 3 stories, which is a bit of a disparity between the number of stories and the meters. Building height, yeah, yep. Metres. So the offices, council pushed for back zoning that area to low medium instead of medium zone,
yep.
Medium density residential zone, and reducing the building heights to 12 metres, which then made it difficult to get that additional story that I was talking about earlier in Mermaid Beach in Miami. Other changes that were progressed in terms of tower form and built form was reduced building site covers for towers,
mm-hmm.
increased setbacks for towers,
yep.
and additional deep planning provisions. In addition to that, we've got sort of a blanket light rail urban renewal overlay,
yep.
which applies to the light rail areas within the city at the moment.
Yeah.
And that affords built form outcomes such as podiums, and that commonly accommodate car parking,
mm-hmm.
which allows developers to go
up
rather than down.
Going down.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cost of money is there. Yep. It's pretty common.
Mm-hmm.
The council offices, as part of the major 2 and 3, push forward with changing that light rail urban renewal overlay to be more sort of structured for podiums around the centres and then sort of tapering away beyond the centres. They want that built form intensity around the centres, but, that has implications on yield, significant implications on yield.
Massive.
So council was progressing those changes 2016 to 2020 sort of thing, and then we had the pandemic.
Mm.
And that really has flipped the market on its head, and then we've got the state government bringing in the new Southeast Queensland Regional Plan, which identifies for the Gold Coast that we need 143,000 new homes within the next 25 years in the urban areas.
Wow.
So the urban areas sort of establish where future urban growth will be,
mm-hmm.
and particularly for the Gold Coast, that's along the coastal strip.
Yeah.
And in sort of more medium density residential areas like Southport and those sort of places.
Yeah.
And that council's major 2 and 3 is sort of at odds with what's needed for the SEQ regional plan in terms of the housing and dwelling supply. So for council, it was just an unfortunate matter of timing in terms of the progression of those changes, the change in the market, SEQ regional plan coming into effect, the draft coming out, sorry. And then the state government, and undertaking their review, final review, said to council that we don't think the changes you're proposing are going to meet our state interests, which involve housing supply. And then they've gone back to council and said, you need to do more work here and we don't support the changes.
Okay.
And now council has put those changes on ice and decided to progress with a new city plan, essentially, which I think is the right move.
Yep.
And we're looking forward to seeing that evolve over the next couple of years. But I think there's a real push from the new city planning chairman, Councillor Hamill, to really drive those changes and get them into effect sooner rather than later.
Yeah, well, because this housing issue, the housing shortage, is an issue that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, absolutely. Very
immediately.
Yep.
All right. What do you, from a town planning perspective, what will be the critical, let's say, 3 critical areas that you'd look at to make the process, or to address the process, or at least to make it better?
Yeah, look, I think for us, probably a couple of things, but I'd like to really see the developers work with builders early on
mm-hmm.
to identify how they can actually deliver a project, a feasible project, and particularly that lower to middle market element. Because at the moment, we're really only seeing sort of middle market stuff being delivered by sort of your Mosaics and the Barry Morrises.
Yep.
And then obviously all the coastal beachfront, high-end, $1.5 million plus product, which is not really hitting that lower end of the market.
Yep.
And if the state government directed council to introduce all of this housing essentially into the existing urban areas, we're going to need to see more of that lower end of the market being delivered. That's right. But to do that, there's going to need to be some really good sort of ideas run with builders and developers about how to actually achieve that. I've got one client at the moment that's looking at developing a site in Southport.
Yeah.
Where they're looking at only putting above ground car parking. I think it's a really good idea. So you're really saving cost efficiencies instead of going down.
Yeah, well, you're saving, I'd say you're saving at least close to $1,000 a square meter.
Yeah. Yep.
If there you go. More.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's directly then returned to the price of the unit. And, and the nature of this stock as well, it's 2-bedroom, pretty small units in the back streets of Southport. It's exactly where we want this sort of product for the city. And in terms of the built form outcome, if the developer were to go higher for more yield, they'd put in basements. But instead of doing that, they said, no, we're going to get something that's actually deliverable. And it also allows the guys to use their current builders who they've got in Brisbane. So that the cost of the project might be half, less than half, because of
such,
so much less yield and also no basements. So they're really just doing two levels of podium and then I think about 10 or 12 stories of resi above that. The floor plate's quite large and a lot of yield jammed in there, about 8 or 10 units per level. But I think it's a really good way to approach the housing shortage.
That's an amazing way to approach a housing shortage, because from a, I'm thinking about it from a delivery perspective, if you don't have a basement or a couple of basements, you're saving on time.
Absolutely.
It's less risk, right?
Yep.
Every day you're in the ground, it's risk.
Yep.
You don't know what you're going to bump into. You don't know what you're going to hit. Weather, right? You can't really do any works in the, you know, in the ground when it's raining.
Yeah.
Right? And if we have a year like we had 2 years ago, or 2022, where we had the most wet days, and you're stuck in the basement, that's a lot of risk for the developer. So I actually love that model where we're going podium.
Yeah.
You know, we dress it up however we need to dress it up.
Exactly right.
You know, facade, whatever the treatment needs to be, go podium, you save on time. It's from a capacity and capability perspective as well. As you said, with the Brisbane builder, now all of a sudden it's less risk for a builder. You don't need to go to a tier two, tier three, or tier one, and they're more comfortable with not going into the ground. Because as soon as you're talking one or two level basements, even if you go three, like a lot of builders are like, you know what? This is not for me. I'd rather stay.
That's exactly what's happened with this project. This builder from Brisbane said, yeah, I'm comfortable with taking that on without the basements.
Yeah.
So you've just broadened your scope for who you can involve in terms of the construction process.
Yeah.
And if we look to do that on a wider scale across the city, you know, you're delivering more housing sooner and with a broader range of builders. So you're sort of then having a more competitive market as well.
And the developers still stay happy because you're still making some money.
That's right. That's right.
Because at the moment, well, your build price is competitive.
Mm.
You know, once you're above ground and you're taking on less risk, it's time. You know, it's just a cycle.
Yeah.
So I actually like that idea.
Yeah, I think it's good.
Yeah.
But we sort of haven't tested the waters with the council offices yet. It's been done before, but typically where you're dealing with, say, flooding constraints.
Yep.
So you won't go and do a basement. You'll elevate your podium level, maybe meter and a half or whatever meter off the ground and allow for flood water underneath storage. But this would be from a real delivery of affordable product. That's sort of the approach we'll be taking with the council offices.
Yep.
And be liaising with the divisional councillor and Councillor Hamill as well, the planning chair, to say, look, this is the model that we want to press forward and we want it to be sort of the flagship model.
Yeah.
And something that we want council to get behind and support us on.
Yeah.
So hopefully we can deliver this project that would inspire other developers and do the same.
I really do hope it gets the legs, because those are the ideas we need.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
Those are the ideas that get us moving quickly.
Yeah.
Like at the moment we're getting stuck in the ground. The program is a nightmare and the construction costs are ridiculous.
Hmm.
Right. And for you to provide an affordable product, it all has to stack up, right? You need to be doing it for the right price.
That's right.
And if you're going down, right, it's always going to be expensive.
Absolutely.
Like a few years ago, you'd say it was 1,500 a meter, you know, a two-level basement. Now you're north of 2,000.
Right.
So it's those are the minor tweaks, or actually major tweaks that you can make, and it just makes everything move quicker. So I really like that.
Yeah. And so this has been driven from a conversation between developer and builder.
Yep.
And I really think that the builder's voice is what's lacking from the planning sort of development phase.
Yep.
And I'd really like to see that as council progresses its city plan, future city plan amendment, or new city plan rather, that they do some consultation with builders to say, what are your ideas about how we can deliver more housing sooner to really hit these numbers that we need to hit to deliver the 143,000 homes.
Yeah, well, it goes back to the relationships we're talking about, right? Having the relationships. I feel the builder's voice was not listened to for a while, right? I've had conversations with builders for years, and part of it was, we're not making much money out of this. We've got 1-2% margin, and it's only a matter of time in this competitive market that a few of us are going to go under. And then it's moved into the pricing, the supply rates. They're ridiculous. You know, we need rise and fall provisions. It moved into, well, what you're talking about now, buildability. But the relationship between developer and builder, like in general, there's some that are good there, was you're on the other side and I'm on this side. I'm trying to make my margin and you need to deliver it on time and you make what you make and I'm not trying to give you any extra dollar, right? And it's where now, and really, which is part of the reason I have these conversations, is we all need to problem solve together because the projects are there, all right? They're not going ahead. We need the builder input because it's very important. They're the ones who are actually going to deliver the product.
That's right.
And they're the ones who are going to do the work. And they're the ones who have the subcontractor relationships and who know what's really happening on the ground, going back to experience. And the earlier we get them in, right, and the earlier they become part of the conversation and it's not, your job is to just deliver this product, give me a price and do it. And your job is greater than that, which is what a DNC model and early contractor involvement was meant to be, where you come in, you bring in your smarts, we work from concept together, right? From when you're getting town planning advice to a point where we've got a DA set and we lodge it with council, right? And we just progress the design and we know what we're building, we know what the price is, we've got price checks every 6 weeks, every month, whenever, where we're actually having some checkpoints to know what our pricing looks like. That's, you're definitely right. That's the missing piece, right? The voice of the builder is important and it needs to be listened to a lot more and it wasn't. So that's really good points. I like to finish off our interviews with a personal question, like get to know my guest, have a conversation and just understand the drivers behind the person or life lessons. My question for you is, if you were to have dinner with 18-year-old Sam, right, today, and you're giving him some words of advice or teaching him some lessons, you know, to take into life for the next years and his journey and his career, how would that conversation go? What would be the highlight points, or what would you like to teach him or tell him?
Hey, good question, Kuda. I'd probably say, you know, be a sponge.
Yep.
Really listen to those around you.
Yep.
Because I think, you know, no one's born with that, the skills and the knowledge. You sort of develop all that as you grow and not just professionally, but personally as well, you know, in yourself. And as an 18-year-old, those are some formative years for an adolescent moving into adulthood, and you sort of start to develop your keel and how you're going to present yourself personally and professionally. And I think, you know, taking on board from those with experience around you, be it family members or those in your professional workplace, and identifying both from some aspects that are good from some operators and some things that are bad, and knowing what you don't want to be and don't want to do, and knowing where you want to be and what you want to do. So yeah, I think listening, taking it in, being a sponge, I think that's something that I really sort of push towards my younger self, which I've started to do obviously as I've advanced my career. But back being a strong-headed 18-year-old, didn't want to listen to anyone.
You think you know everything?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And you know you fall down and you get back up and you learn from those mistakes. But that's certainly taking it all in, listen to those around you and those with more experience. Find some good mentors and, I'd say probably
just one.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's really fascinating because that's one of my life philosophies, which is you can learn something from anyone, right?
Mm.
Everyone's got something to teach you. It doesn't matter whether they're the worst individual on earth or you believe they're the worst individual on earth or the greatest individual. There's a lesson in something they say, right? Yeah. There's a lesson there, either, as you said, in something that you shouldn't do, all right, or what you should avoid, the pitfalls, or, you know, where you're lacking and where you should be focusing on. And it's the conversations and just learning. We don't know anything,
That's right. Yeah, there's always more out there.
There's always more knowledge. There's always more stuff you learn. You know, it's the conversations and listen more than you speak.
Yeah.
It's a
good motto.
It's always important to actually learn from people and people who know. And, you know, you may think they don't know, but there's always a jewel. There's always a nugget somewhere.
Yeah. That's right.
It's a, you just got to find it.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about you, Kuda? What would you be telling your 18-year-old self?
That's a really good question. I didn't think about this. It's the world, well, it's really, it's a, well, it's not a harsh one. It's, you don't know anything, right? Which is pretty similar to what you're saying, but it's a, you don't know anything, and the world is, not even the world, life, there's more to life than what you know, and just try to embrace it and enjoy it and learn as much as you can. Never stay stagnant and always have that self-belief.
Yeah.
Right. There's that next level. Yeah. Probably when I was 18, I thought what I thought was important, I don't see it as important now. Right. I did have the vision, but you know, you just don't know what's out there.
Right.
To give you a context, at 18, I was still in Zimbabwe, right?
Yep.
So I'm from Zimbabwe originally and didn't know a thing about the Gold Coast, right?
Yep.
So perspective, nothing about the Gold Coast, nothing about the property market, nothing about construction. Didn't interest me at all, right?
Yeah.
And, well.
Here you are.
Here I am. Yep. So, and I could not have imagined it. I wanted to be a lawyer, actually.
Right.
So I was going to be a lawyer. I was applying to all these unis to become a lawyer. And yeah, now I'm in a totally different field, doing something totally different, but loving it. And, you know, it's the life path. So be open to life, be open to what it teaches you. You don't know anything, and it's the best thing because you learn a lot.
That's right.
Thanks. It's the first time someone's actually asked me a question, and I'm like, actually, I hadn't thought about that. No, Sam, really appreciate it. Really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to just come and have a chat with me, have a conversation, and talk the industry. I really took a lot out of this. I hope, you know, the people watching and listening took a lot of this, because there's some nuggets and some jewels in there. And thanks for taking the time, mate. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kuda. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, mate.
See ya.